As far as we know, the ability to dream about the future is something that makes humans unique among all other animals. And among all humans, it seems Americans are trained from birth that we should never give up on our dreams. But what do we dream about, and what do we decide to do with those fantasies? It's affected in surprising ways by our identities, socioeconomic status, race, gender, and age. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Karen A. Cerullo is professor of sociology at Rutgers University and editor of Sociological Forum. Her book, written with co-author Janet M. Ruan, identifies some patterns in the things we dream about based on our place in society. Among the big surprises it reveals, most of us don't actually put fame and fortune at the top of the list. The book is called Dreams of a Lifetime: How Who We Are Shapes How We Imagine Our Future. Karen, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Just to be absolutely clear here, we're talking about waking dreams, our fantasies about the future, and not the dreams we have while we sleep. How do you define dreams for purposes of your research? How is a dream different from an aspiration or a hope or a plan?
Well, we feel that things like aspirations or hope are grounded in reality and involve planning. So if you think about the large literature on aspirations, it's mostly about people's career goals and educational goals. And it's all about how to achieve them, how to make a plan to get there. In many ways, the same is true about hope. You hope for a happy marriage, you discover you're ill and you hope to get better. Somehow those events are always grounded in reality. But dreams are kind of a different beast. These are those thoughts we have when we're secluded in our own minds, thinking about the future and thinking about things that we may never do, but ideas that we'd like to see happen or that make us feel excited. They tell us really something about what's at the core of our identity. Who do we really think we are? Who do we really want to be?
Who did you approach to be part of your research sample? Like, what kind of demographic information did you collect from each person you spoke with?
Well, we went out to target a wide variety of people. We talked to over 272 people, some of them in one-on-one interviews, some of them in small focus groups with five or six people. And we started with kids who were in the third and fourth grade, so that was roughly ages 8 to 10. All the way up to people who were in their 80s. We talked to people who were at different stages of life. We talked to people who were from different demographic backgrounds, so different social classes, different races. We talked to people who were being challenged at the time of our study by things like health emergencies or displacement because of a natural disaster or poverty, or people who had lost their jobs. So we really had a wide array of people to get as the most we could out of what it is people think about when they're dreaming about the future.
It's actually a pretty personal question. Were most of the people you approached willing to be pretty candid about their dreams?
We were very surprised that people were quite open about their dreams, quite excited to talk about them. And, you know, when we met with people, we asked them, if you knew you couldn't fail, what would you do? Or who would you want to be? Or where would you want to go? Or what would you want to have? And we asked people to write down three things. And we found then that when we started talking, they were very open. They talked about the very same things they had written down. No one got shy and sort of changed their answers. And they were very happy to elaborate. We asked all kinds of things about their dreams, you know, what maybe the themes of those dreams were, who was in the dreams with them, how long they had held the dreams. Did they want to pass their dreams on to someone else? Did they think their dreams were feasible? And we also asked them how important they thought it was to dream. How important was the activity itself?
Did most people say it was important?
Amazing majority of people said it was important. In fact, even people who told us that they thought there was literally no chance that they would ever accomplish their dream said that nevertheless, it was really important to dream. And, you know, this was really driven home to both myself and my co-author. We were watching an interview that a New York Times reporter was doing with a soldier in the Ukraine right at the very beginning of the war. And the soldier had all kinds of questions about the Super Bowl for the New York Times reporter. He wanted to know so much about it. And at the end of the interview, he told the reporter, "This is my dream. And I know it's going to happen. Someday I'm going to get to the United States and I'm going to attend the Super Bowl." And we thought, boy, there you are in the midst of a fog of war. And not only do you still have a dream, but you are sure it's going to happen. And that was kind of the microcosm of how important dreams are to people and how sure people are that they should continue dreaming no matter what.
And they're important to us. I think we can understand that if things are going badly, you want to dream about something better. But it turns out people who say they're quite content with their actual lives are big dreamers as well.
Absolutely. You know, this project kind of started as a fluke. I was doing some errands for the Christmas holiday, and a broadcaster on the radio posed the question, "If you knew you couldn't fail, what would you do?" And I'm pretty satisfied with my life. It's not that I was around, you know, thinking, "Oh, I wish I had done this. I wish I had done that." But I had no trouble answering the question. Lots of things came to my mind, you know, writing and starring in a Broadway play, or opening a little flower shop somewhere, or training dogs. You know, I love dogs. And I asked my co-author the same question, and she said without hesitation, I'd like to be the next Oprah. And I'd like to be living on the beach." And so we started asking our relatives at the Christmas table that very question: "If you knew you couldn't fail, what would you do?" And my mother-in-law, who was then 95, said that she would have liked to be a lounge singer, which just floored me, because she would certainly sing around the house when she was doing the dishes. But the idea that she was just really attracted to this idea of going out every night and singing in the lounge was an eye-opener, as it was for one of my brothers to say he wanted to be president of the United States, another to say he wanted to be the star pitcher for the Yankees, and a sister-in-law to tell me that she'd love to have a bed and breakfast in a very exclusive area. So I learned all sorts of things about family members that I never knew before. And as you said, it wasn't as if they were dissatisfied with their lives, but these dreams were about something that was sort of deep within them, whether it be a need for recognition or a sense of community or a sense of power or a sense of sociability. Those dreams were tapping into something that everyday life wasn't offering.
Karen, what were some of the most common themes you were able to identify by collecting dreams from different kinds of people?
Well, you know, when we started, we thought one of two things was going to happen, that like conventional wisdom, dreams would be such an individualistic thing that we would have just constantly varied dreams. On the other end of the scale, we thought, well, you know, we're talking to Americans. Maybe everybody's just going to spout the American dream. But we found that things were somewhere in the middle, that there were some themes that we could isolate: dreams about careers, dreams about adventure, dreams about fame, wealth, and power, dreams about being a great philanthropist, dreams about family, and dreams about self-improvement. But there was some limitation to the themes, and often the choice of themes and many of the other differences we found when talking about dreams were very much influenced by what we call people's social location, that is, their social class, their race, their gender, their stage of life, and whether or not they were facing any kinds of adversities at the time that we did the interview.
Were you surprised at how few people told you they dreamed about, like, winning the Powerball and moving to a private island?
Absolutely. I thought that that was going to be a very popular answer. And after the first interview or two, I started asking people, "Have you ever thought about winning the lottery? I'm surprised no one's mentioned that." And what people said was, "Well, you know, I want to have a dream that I work at and that I've earned. And winning the lottery would be sort of a given to me. It would be a gift." And that, people said, was not what their dreams were about. So I was very much surprised that we did not get that answer.
What patterns did you notice among people who talked about career dreams as their sort of primary focus?
Well, you know, there were variations. Take, for example, social class. People who were very, very wealthy, when they talked about careers, it was becoming doctors, lawyers, being the CEO of a large corporation, starting an angel investor sort of situation. They were really thinking big. Whereas people who were in the lower classes, by their own definition, would have smaller dreams. They would want to have a job that they could keep, for example, and not even be specific about what the job was. Or they would want to start a small business, a delicatessen, a flower shop. So both groups were dreaming about career, but in very, very different ways.
Broadly speaking, what kinds of people dream primarily about adventure?
Well, we found that it was more common for men to have adventure dreams than it was for women. In fact, we felt that there was a little bit of a sort of stereotypical dreaming going on when we compared men and women. Men were most often telling us about being famous or powerful, or talking about adventures like, you know, whitewater rafting or going to space. Women certainly had career dreams and so forth, but more often they were dreaming things about family, having children, having a happy marriage, reconciling family members who perhaps weren't talking to one another for long periods of time. And they also dreamed a lot about self-improvement, which I'm sad to say, but it's the stereotype, involved the way they looked, losing weight, getting, wishing they were prettier, wishing their hair looked better, those kinds of things.
So men don't tend to have those magic makeover dreams where they, you know, walk out into the world much more attractive than they were the day before.
Not at all. Not a single one.
You tried to sort these dreams by feasibility. So talk about the sort of divide that exists between the dreams that are within realistic reach and the ones that are either unlikely to happen or actually impossible.
Well, certainly when we talked to those third graders, the feasibility of the dreams was very, very low. You know, we had kids telling us they wanted to own a giraffe. They wanted to fly like Superman. They wished they could hold their breath forever underwater. Feasibility for the very young was an issue. But there were also other people in different age groups that had some dreams that I think it would be safe to say were not feasible. We talked to one man in his 60s who wished he could levitate himself. We talked to a man in his 70s who had very little in the way of financial resources and no political background, but wanted to be the president of the United States. And when we pressed him a little bit on that, he said, well, you know, Trump had no political background, but he was able to do it. And so you never know, he said. I've had this dream all my life since President Kennedy, and I've always wanted to accomplish it. And I think maybe it could happen.
Karen, you mentioned that when you talk to third graders, you know, their dreams are all over the map and they might dream about things that are physically impossible. By fourth grade, surprisingly, this starts to change a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was one of the surprising findings that we came across here. Something happens between the age of 8 and 10. And suddenly those fourth graders who are, you know, 9 and 10 years old, start to fall into line, so to speak, and start dreaming about the kinds of things that adults are dreaming about. Somehow they learn what's appropriate and what's inappropriate to dream about. And they learn a little bit more about what's realistic and what's not realistic. So that really seemed to be a cutting edge moment in terms of age for how people dream.
Next big shift comes in adolescence and young adulthood. What do people in that age group tend to dream about?
Tends to be a lot of career dreaming. And that makes sense, of course, because you get people who are at these turning points in their life, finishing high school and thinking about what to do next, finishing college and the same thing, thinking about what to do next. So there are a lot of career dreams among that group. But there are also some adventure dreams. I know When I talked to the college age students, for example, they said, we've been working really hard for the last 4 or 5 years. And before I get a job, I want to have an adventure. So a lot of them wanted to travel the globe. Many of them wanted to live abroad for a year and see what it was like to live in another country. Many of them had, dreams related to trying their hand at sports or singing or acting. So a combination of career and adventure, sort of taking a breather for the college students.
So many doors are still open to people at that age. By midlife, a lot of those doors will have closed just, by virtue of the fact that we've had to make choices over time. What do people dream about in midlife?
Well, this was again another big surprise for us because we thought when we talked to people, particularly in early midlife, people who had been married a few years, had started their families, we thought we were going to hear a lot about the dreams that they had for their children's futures or things that they wanted to do to secure their families, dreams about, career or vacations or things like that. And what we found is that early midlife group was the least likely to engage in much dreaming at all. And when we pressed them on that, they said, dreaming is a luxury I can't afford right now. My number one responsibility has to make sure that my kids are safe and that my kids are on the right path. And so I feel like I've had to close the door on that part of my life temporarily. So we were surprised by that there was this sort of little bit of a desert area, so to speak, about dreams.
But I absolutely love that that door flings wide open again as people approach later life. And you found that older folks, I mean, they know what's real and what's not, but they're the ones for whom the sky is the limit when it comes to dreaming.
Absolutely. They were the most fun to interview, I have to say. And the interviews and the focus groups went on the longest. They had some very exciting dreams. Talked with one woman who wanted to motorcycle cross country with her daughter, and she could describe to me even the jackets they were going to have made up and what they were going to say and what they were going to look like. A man who told me he played the piano and he thought that he could become Liberace. He admired Liberace and thought that even if it were on a small scale, he could become that kind of persona. So we had a lot of excitement and a lot of people who said, I think this could happen. What? Why not? And it better happen fast. They saw their dreams as short-term dreams because they knew their time was limited.
It is such an American trope to never give up on our dreams, but it turns out to be a real thing, right? Most people told you they would never let go of their number one dream, even when they were aware it would never happen.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we did in our study was to look at, what are the cultural lessons out there about dreaming? What are we exposed to as we're growing up, as we're living? And we looked at the messages that come from film and books and television and, our stories about heroes and national history and so forth. And, we found overwhelmingly there's more positive lessons, things like opportunity is boundless. And dream big. Don't ever give up on your dreams. And if you're optimistic, anything is possible. By the same token, we did find that there were a couple of negative lessons out there. The idea that the deck might be stacked against certain people, and the idea if that you rise high and far, that you could fall very hard as well. And whether you embrace those positive or negative dreams again was very much tied to especially social class and certain race backgrounds.
Tell us about the socioeconomic and demographic patterns you found in people's tendency to either embody the positive messages about dreaming or the negative messages.
What was most striking, I think, was in terms of social class, people who were in working, middle, and upper classes overwhelmingly embraced those positive ideas about dreaming. People who were in the lower classes overwhelmingly embraced those negative lessons, and particularly the idea that the deck was stacked against them. Now, that's not to say that they didn't dream and they didn't think it was important, but they were most likely to say that they understood this was never going to happen for them. And we found some differences with regard to race, too. And in particular, those we interviewed from a Latin background, so people from Puerto Rico, people from Mexico, people from the Dominican Republic, for example, these groups were more likely than any other racial group to embrace the negative lessons on dreaming. And they were least confident about ever being able to achieve their dreams.
When people told you they dreamed about self-improvement, were there variations according to how much money, what resources people had?
Yeah, there definitely were. Wealthy people who talked about self-improvement wanted to sort of improve their environment. So they wanted to improve their work environment or to improve their position in a business, to make more money, to just move further up the ladder. Whereas people who were disadvantaged financially, when they talked about self-improvement, they often sort of presented themselves as if there was something wrong with them. And so they needed to work on, oh, language skills or personality or communication skills and so forth. So it was much more personal for people.
Karen, did people ever name or claim inherited dreams as their own? Did they ever say, I'm doing this because my grandpa really dreamed of, me coming up with an economic policy that creates equality in this country?
No, actually, most of the dreams that people talk to us about, they said were their, original feelings. And that was because, as they described dreams, they talked about them as a piece of themselves, that part of themselves or a place they would go to that was really the core of their identity, who they really were. And so we did not get people who said, who they really were carrying out their father's or grandfather's or someone else's dreams, even though they themselves said that they would like to pass their own dreams on.
Well, this other really American notion is that anybody who is willing to work hard enough can achieve whatever it is they dream about. I mean, there are lots of reasons, sadly, to doubt that this is true, given the amount of inequality in this country. But did most people seem to think their at least realistic dreams would come true as long as they applied themselves?
We certainly heard that a lot. I mean, the exceptions to that were, again, people who were in the lower classes, people who were from a Latin background were certainly exceptions to that rule. But in general, people felt that, if they worked hard enough, they might not achieve the actual dream, but they might get something close to it. And, you're right in saying this is so American. Several years ago, I wrote a book called Never Saw It Coming, which was a book about how people, even people who are hired to envision worst case scenarios, even professionals as well as everyday people, have a hard time envisioning worst case scenarios. And that is so American. We are trained to be optimistic. If you meet someone who is not optimistic, they're a sad sack, they're a Debbie Downer. We kind of stigmatize people like that. So our dreamers were definitely embracing this idea that let's have the dream and then let's work toward it. And by gosh, it's going to happen for us. We certainly have a lot of popular culture that encourages that. I think back to the book The Secret, where you put your wish under your pillow and you'll wake up and it will happen. There's more books out there like that than there are books about the importance of planning or being realistic.
Just to be clear, as a social scientist, you're not endorsing The Secret here as a way to get what you want.
No, I'm saying it's not a way to get what you want, that will not likely get you further along.
Karen, I really enjoyed this book to the extent that, as you say, there are some very American dream tropes. One is that we never give up, one is that we can all make our dreams come true if we work hard enough. The book made me a little hungry to have sociologists in societies all over the world do similar studies. I would love to know how different the responses might be in China or Russia or Brazil or anywhere else.
We would too, and we hope that that's the next project that we can undertake. We'd love to see if this is a uniquely American phenomenon, or if people in Western Europe and Asia and South America are having the same sorts of optimism. My guess is that it's exaggerated in the United States, but who knows? It's a question for research.
What did you learn about how a significant health crisis might affect the way people relate to their dreams and what they dream about after that crisis?
Again, it was one of the big surprises for us because we interviewed a lot of people who had health challenges. Most of them were cancer patients who were undergoing treatment or had just completed treatment. And they were probably the single most optimistic group that we talked to.
Really?
It was just jarring to us because going through an event like that, you would think would dampen people's enthusiasm a little bit, but they were rejuvenated and they were dreaming big. I had one woman, for example, who told me that she had a small ministry, and now that she had been treated, she wanted to write a book and have a radio show so that she would have a national audience for her ministry. Another woman who told me that she wanted to move to Big Sur and have a farm where she could rescue horses and boxers. Another who wanted to move to Tuscany and own a farm in Tuscany and have a vineyard in Tuscany. So a lot of big dreams, and more than any other group, they were absolutely sure that these dreams could come true. They were the most optimistic and the most enthusiastic, which was heartwarming and also surprising to us.
It's interesting because one would think their big dream would be, being declared cancer-free or having their heart condition successfully treated or whatever it is. But it's almost like that's a given in these dream scenarios. And then after that is when they do the really big thing.
Either a given or a wish, and they're sort of dreaming from that vantage point that they're okay. But yeah, we were surprised.
Why is it important, do you think, for all of us to have dreams? I mean, it's got to be important if these are almost a universal thing. Why do you think we want our dreams?
Well, I think people dream for different reasons. There are some people who sort of retreat into that life because it makes them feel calm, or it makes them feel happy, or it rejuvenates them, or it excites them. We had a number of people who told us that when something bad happened in their life, they would retreat to their dreams because it would sort of help them recover from a disappointment. Other people are dreaming, I think, because they do think there's a possibility that something they're dreaming about can happen. And that's where we feel it's important to talk to people about why they're dreaming, because it's important to know that dreams don't happen magically. And that's what I was trying to get at earlier when I was talking about The Secret. You can think something, that doesn't mean it's going to happen to you. You have to work to get it. And not everybody has the know-how or the skills about how to achieve their dreams. So we talk in the end of the book about the fact that, gosh, when we send kids off to high school or college and we find out they're deficient in, let's say, math, we give them remedial help in so that they'll catch up with everyone else. And the same is true for dreams. People that we find are having a hard time dreaming, or don't feel that it's worth their effort because their dreams won't come true. We think there can be remedial help there too, so that you can turn your dream into a project where you can plan and at least more move toward accomplishing it, to perhaps not achieve the exact dream, but get you somewhere close.
Karen, you mentioned, not everyone necessarily has the skills or the specific plan to make their dreams come true. There's also this question of resources. You know, you've already mentioned that, you know, people at the very lowest rung of the economic ladder just don't bother dreaming big because they don't believe it's going to come true. What are some things we could do as a society to make dreams at least potentially possible for everyone in this country, including those who are currently facing the greatest hardships?
One of the first things I think we have to do is recognize how damaging it can be to for people who don't feel they even should dream, because it's almost as if the game is over before it's even begun for people like that. And I think we don't realize that there are groups of people in our country who have that level of despondency, even in the privacy of their own thoughts. And it's important for us to recognize that. But it's also important then for us to think about ways to get resources to people so that people have a fair shot at achieving something that might be important to them, something that they think could be wonderful for their future. And that's very hard. People don't like to think about asking for more resources. Everybody feels they're already strapped. But unless we can provide some resources for people who are in disadvantaged locations, and that might be monetary resources, but it also might be social resources, you know, eliminating biases that get in the way of people moving ahead. Unless that happens, we're going to lose a lot of man and woman power in terms of what could be accomplished as the future unfolds.
I did think about, you know, many elementary school teachers will ask kids like to draw a picture of what they want to be when they grow up or what they dream about. And there are these adorable pictures of kids dressed up like firefighters and astronauts and chefs and everything else. At least when I went to school, this wasn't necessarily followed up by, you know, that's great. Here are some of the things you can do to get on that path.
And it would be wonderful. And actually, in researching the book, I found that there are a couple of tools for teachers who that they could use in their classroom to first get kids talking about dreaming and then get kids talking about how they might accomplish it. I have to say that one of the saddest things I heard from a fourth grader was that her dream was to be a grocery packer. She wanted to work in a supermarket and bag groceries. And as I left classroom, I said something to her teacher about that, how sad that made me. And she said, you know, I have a feeling it's that food is lacking in her household. And there's something very attractive about being around food. Mm. And, you know, again, when you think about that, there is something we could do about that. And it's important for us to know that this is what's going on in the minds of people so that we can at least try to make a plan to help people.
Karen A. Cerullo is professor of sociology at Rutgers University and editor of Sociological Forum. Her new book, written with co-author Janet M. Ruan, is called Dreams of a Lifetime: How Who We Are Shapes How We Imagine Our Future. Karen, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It was wonderful.
You can like our page on Facebook. On Twitter, you can find us at the handle K-E-R-A Think. That's also what you search for if you want our podcast. It is available free wherever you get podcasts. We do hope that you will subscribe. You can also check out what we've got planned for upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.